Despite some rain that fell over the central coast this winter, we're still in a serious drought, and it could get more serious by next spring. This is Central Coast AVA. I'm Jason Lopez. Let's talk about sustainable water practices in wine country. First, a bit of a preface, some news items to help frame the story. In the San Joaquin Valley, Tulare County is the top agricultural county in the U.S., with production worth $6.9 billion. But there's a race to the bottom, more than 1,000 feet, as some farmers go for broke to extract well water to dangerously low levels. Though the state's new groundwater law transitions into reality, starting in 2020, it might take a decade to have any real effect on drilling. On the Central Coast, where there's a higher population of non-farm citizens, Drill Baby Drill isn't so popular. The controversy over Justin Winery's clear-cutting of oaks and the plans to build a holding lake for water helped to raise consciousness of the need for conservation. The perceptions about who's wasting water can go both ways. Homeowners trying to keep green lawns and swimming pools, farmers drilling for every last drop. But it's not necessarily farmers versus residents. There are plenty of homeowners and farmers committed to conservation as well. Over the summer, farmers and technologists got together in Salinas for the Forbes AgTech Summit, and the issue of water conservation was a main event during panel discussions. Stuart Wolf, whose father started farming in the San Joaquin Valley in the 1940s, says their operation uses the latest technologies in micro-irrigation and enclosed transport of water. But here's the nuance. He understands that some farmers and industries aren't playing fair and make regulation necessary. So even though Wolf Farms has a save-every-drop approach, he says state and local agency intervention often is clumsy and gets in the way.
Essentially, we take the position how can the government really screw things up and just assume that's what's going to happen and then build a model around that, right? So, and I have to say they delivered, so.
People in agriculture also say social media isn't helping. A Mother Jones web article that went viral earlier this year decried the amount of water it takes to grow almonds, a depiction that many in agriculture say is distorting. Eric Averett, general manager of the Rosedale Rio Bravo Water Storage District near Bakersfield, added this insight.
I saw an article a while back that said, it takes X number of gallons to grow an almond. Right. Is that necessary or an appropriate use of water, but they didn't take into account how many gallons it takes to grow their pizza.
Farmers realize they sometimes come off looking like the bad guy, since growing food is so water intensive. Not so with Daniel Mountjoy, director of resource stewardship at a San Francisco-based organization called Sustainable Conservation. He knows the Central Coast, having spent time working on water issues with the Natural Resources Conservation Service. He emphasizes the need for partnership.
Water is regional in California. It's hard to talk about the whole state in any one way. So the Central Coast is distinct from the Central Valley in Northern California in that it doesn't, for the most part, does not have imported water. It does some in the southern Central Coast. But certainly the Monterey and San Luis Obispo regions don't have imported water options. So we're really dependent on our winter runoff, but primarily for agriculture, it's groundwater. And that groundwater supply has been depleted over many, many years.
Is this going to be something where it's just going to get regulated because it has to? Or do you think
I think the sort of the brilliance of this Sustainable Groundwater Management Act that was passed last year is that it does require each and every local jurisdiction to come up with their own water management plan. And that's going to force the local counties to do that, San Luis Obispo included. And if they don't, the state's going to intervene. And that's a worse consequence for most districts than finding their own regulations, but it's going to force the communities to work together, and that's a smart kind of regulation, giving locals the opportunity to solve their own problems.
And you see that happening right now?
Oh, it is happening. Yeah, they have till 2017 to finish their formation of their agencies. They only have till 2020 to finish their plans, and then they have to start reporting how they're doing on those plans. And if they're out of compliance, the state's going to step in.
Yeah, and I imagine the state will be very conservative in how they make rules.
That's kind of the regulation that you were talking about. I mean, that's what people don't want to see happen, is sort of draconian cuts. But the local agencies, the ones that have gotten ahead of this already, Pajaro is again a location where their agency is formed. They're starting to talk about how they're going to manage that supply. Yes, there's going to be restrictions, but they're going to be equitably designed and everyone's going to participate in setting them. And we have to live within our means or we all go down in the long run.
Maybe we can drill down a little bit, but let me just ask an overarching question. What's the future of water for the Central Coast?
I think it's really going to be trade-offs between urban and ag, in the sense that society is going to just have to decide what economically they value in terms of land use. But then within agriculture and within urban, it's going to be about conservation. We're going to have to conserve, but we're also going to have to try and capture more of our winter storm events. Right now, that water typically runs off paved urban lands and off plastic covered agricultural lands, and we're losing water that historically soaked into the ground that could be pumped later. Think about the big reservoir that's sitting under our feet that's not filled right now, the one that we keep complaining about being overdrafted and the salt water intruding. That's a free reservoir that's already built, and we're not effectively filling it. It's like a bank account we've pumped dry, but we're forgetting to deposit. And the deposit could be very inexpensive if we let the land function. So rather than building new tanks under our homes, we need that roof runoff not to go down the gutter to the street, or farm runoff to go down into the streams, but instead spread it back on lands where it can be captured and held for short times, 24 hours, and soak back in.
And now, this is a sensitive question, but it's one that's come up in slow these days, and that has to do with how large corporate farmers
right.
treat water apparently differently than the smaller guys do. What's your sense about that?
I think having financial capital allows some landowners to do more, whether that's pumping more or capturing more. And ultimately, we're all subject to the limitations of our water supply, and especially with the new Groundwater Sustainability Act, that we're all in the same boat together, drinking from the same bathtub. And so large companies, I think, actually have more to lose in the long run if they're investing in more acreage or in processing facilities. And so they ought to be thinking about what the consequences are of short-term overdrafting or getting deeper, pumping from a deeper level. That's going to end too. And so I think I've been working a lot with corporations who actually want to be part of the solution because of that long-term planning horizon that they're looking at. And they want to figure, they don't know how to invest in these long-term supply enhancement strategies. All they know is how to build a bigger well right now. So providing them with information on options is real critical.
So you're optimistic in terms of how the large corporations are going to deal with water in California?
There's large corporations and there's large corporations. Those that see this as a short-term extraction and then run, they could be really damaging to the local water supply. Those that are really investing in, really those that are investing in more infrastructure in the sense of processing wineries or other processing facilities have a longer-term investment that they need to see a return on. And those folks, given the right information about how they can contribute and collaborate with others, I think can play a large role. Driscoll's, for instance, in the Pajaro Valley has played a major role in bringing the community together to help solve these problems.
Collaboration, innovation, conservation, those are easy to say and make a pretty good slogan, but they're serious ideas for Jean-Pierre Wolfe, no relation to Stuart Wolfe, who was quoted earlier. Where do you start with saying who Jean-Pierre is? In the world of Central Coast water, he's about as much on the inside as you can get. Chairman of the Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board, member of the Coastal San Luis Resource Conservation District, Agriculture Liaison Advisory Board, Cal Poly Center for Sustainability. It's a long list. It goes on. Suffice it to say, if you want to talk about Central Coast water, he's your guy. Let's start with one of the many talks he's given about grape growing and sustainability.
How much water does it take to produce 1 gallon of wine? And I know questions are for later, but this is the one where I put you on the spot.
70 gallons.
70 gallons.
100.
500 gallons? 20 gallons? All right, this is like an auction. I like it. So 8 gallons. What? 8 gallons. That includes the irrigation water and the water in the winery to process the wine. Okay, about 8.
It was a fascinating hour about issues of economic, social, and environmental sustainability. But when it comes specifically to water and wine, Jean-Pierre began with a description of the ancient practice of dry farming, which is to coax plants into sending their roots deep to find natural sources of water. If there's any part you should hear from his presentation, it's this section. It's almost like a TED Talk. What scientists and farmers are doing and developing to save water.
Two big components in water use. Evaporation is with the sun and with the wind, how much water evaporates from the ground. And then you have the transpiration of a vine. When it's hot, a vine transpires. The same as we do. Why do we transpire when it's hot? To keep cool, right? Thermodynamics. So same thing with a vine. When you have lots of wind, there is a loss of moisture of a transpiration of a vine. Also, when the leaf moves, it takes energy. You know, a vine is a living thing, so it also consumes water. If we take 100% ET, that means you would irrigate to replenish 100% of evaporation loss and transpiration loss. So typically, we use water deficit irrigation, meaning we irrigate less than the 100%, you know, 80%, 75%. In my case, right now, I am at less than 60. I'm kind of extreme irrigation, and in fact, some of my old vine Chardonnay is dry farmed. I called it extreme dry because, you know, they haven't seen water for 4 years. So that's another methodology to reduce water use. There is a relationship too between water use and crop production. If you're going to have heavy, large, commercial grade crop, you know, for wine that you put on the market at, say, you know, the $5 a bottle, you're going to have to produce more than 4 tons to the acre. You know, you're going to have to be in the, you know, 8, 10 plus tons to the acre. That means more water. What we're looking at too is some of the aspects of irrigation practice or frost protection. Where I'm at in the Edna Valley, we use windmills to take the warm air strata that is above, bring it down, and then move it around the vineyard floor. So that's the principle in using windmills. So, you know, we're looking more and more at how can we be a little smarter. And one of the techniques is also being judicious about the rootstock. A lot of effort currently done in California universities to develop drought-resistant rootstock. The ones I use is 1103P, as in Paul, and those also have high salt tolerance. One of the problem with lack of water quantity is the salt buildup in the ground, because you don't leach out the salt. So developing more drought-tolerant plants and also salt tolerant is a win-win. Some of the far-out studies being done right now in research is to look at some of the genes of plants that do have good drought tolerance. Which plant has great drought tolerance? Cacti. So we're looking at what makes a cacti still thrive in the desert. Well, at nighttime, you have a lot of dew in the desert, right? So the cacti open its pores and basically takes in water at nighttime. And then as soon as the sun comes up, it shuts the pores and it keeps the moisture inside. So the transpiration rate has basically a one-way valve between daytime and nighttime. So some of the research is to take that component and seeing how it could be applied, for example, to rootstocks. So you would end up with a vine that would use less water because you would reduce the transpiration. So, you know, this, you may think, gee, that's Frankenstein wine, but how is it gonna taste? So that's where a lot of research is being done, you know, as the, you know, wine is all about flavors and taste ultimately. So, you know, you have that balance, indeed. We have also done a trial last year with a supplement to our irrigation water, which is a surfactant that changed the surface tension of water. When the water goes in the ground, it allows the roots to have more accessibility to that water. Okay? You may think water is water, but not exactly. So we've done trial with and without, and it's actually quite promising. I have pictures of it. The rows where we used this was markedly, the canopy was healthier than where we didn't have these supplements. So there are all kinds of techniques being considered. You know, there's no silver bullet. It's all a little here, a little there, a little there. But clearly, you know, water is becoming, you know, a very precious commodity. And we need to be aware and realizing that it's, you know, it's finite, and it's our responsibility to do a better job in doing more with less.
Jean-Pierre Wolf was born in Belgium, and as a teenager, he was on a path to study agronomy in college in his home country. But once in college, he switched majors to nuclear engineering and then studied electrical power engineering in the U.S. But all along in the back of his mind was his original dream of a life in agriculture. And he reconnected to it when he started his winery in Edna Valley in the late 90s. Wolf Vineyards is more than a winery. It's a family farm. He runs the operation with his wife, who does the accounting, and with his two sons. It's a nature preserve where Jean-Pierre has created a turtle pond, done stream restoration, even allows deer to eat some of the grapes. And it's his science experiment, which is his passion. The foundation of his water-saving measures is dry farming, a standard practice in many European regions. In France, vines can be watered for the first 3 years after planting, but then have to be weaned off of irrigation.
In California, if you go, you roll back 40 years, dry farming was a standard practice until we discovered drip irrigation, and we're like, ha-ha, you know, I can have wine grapes growing everywhere, you know, including in, you know, desert climate. So I decided to transition, and quite frankly, I had quite a few naysayers saying, you know, oh, you're going to kill those vines. After 3 years, they're dead. Well, you look at this guy. This is like 15 years later. It doesn't look dead to me.
As we walk through his vineyard, he describes how he gets the vines to go deeper for water. By using a tree shank hook, grape farmers can rip the ground just deep enough to give the shallow roots a haircut, as he calls it.
I do every other row every year, so row A this year, B next year. And so that was one technique.
Is that it right there?
Yeah. And typically, I rip every other row, and then I disc every other row, and then I plant a cover crop of winter snow peas, beans, wild oat, you know, as nitrogen fixer. Springtime, I disc that, which becomes a green compost, a green manure. And what it does is help the microbial activity and the soil, and add some good soil complexity with, you know, with green matters in it.
The tilling strategies also include the use of the Yeoman plow. It was developed about 40 years ago in Australia, and its distinction is the ability to open the ground with minimal disturbance.
What it does, it cracks open the ground. It doesn't turn the ground upside down. It doesn't
move the dirt a lot, so you maintain the microbiology of the soil and the soil structure pretty well intact. And you do this at the end of harvest, so when the ground is nice and dry, so it cracks it open and the fissures then go even deeper than the chisel itself.
The benefits include not only giving rain a deeper path into the ground, but it helps to keep carbon in the soil. That helps the soil to maintain its permeability to absorb water. And from a climate change perspective, it prevents carbon from being released into the air.
The benefit there is carbon sequestration, because you have not disturbed the biomass in the soil and the carbon structure of the soil.
As we walk down the rows, Jean-Pierre holds some vines up to show how pruning techniques helps to reduce water consumption. He reveals a bird's nest with baby chicks and says we should leave them alone, so he turns to the other side of the row to demonstrate.
By changing to cane pruning, I increase my yield by 20%.
What's cane pruning? Just to explain that to us.
Okay, cane pruning is, spur pruning is basically like a little dwarf tree where you have branches in every direction.
It's kind of what the Deuces do on the side of the road.
Exactly. Where at, and in their case, it's head pruned, but it's the same concept, all right? With cane pruning, what you do in terms of new wood, you leave 2 to 6 canes per vine of strong wood. And these canes then will produce fruiting shoots. And the benefit of cane pruning is your trellising can be better managed because you have these canes instead of side wood all over the place.
You take all these techniques together on this vine that you've been showing us.
Mm-hmm.
How much water are you saving? How do you compute that?
Well, the amount of water I'm saving, number one, by changing the trellising configuration, there's 15% less water consumption per vine.
It's apparent that what drives Jean-Pierre Wolf to engage in these many techniques and projects is more than an attempt to figure out how to make his winery more profitable. There's also his curiosity as a scientist to understand how agriculture can harmonize crops with natural systems. When it comes to dry farming, his engineering knowledge comes into play in integrating the vineyard with the climate and topography of the Etna Valley.
So if you look behind you, you can see this valley. My property goes beyond these hills, halfway toward the Santa Lucia mountain range there. So this is my watershed. So the storm water that normally would run to the creeks, I basically have a system where I capture the stormwater with drain ditches and culverts. Where you stand here are the equivalent of rice paddies. The water come in from block to block to block through culverts. The road is slightly elevated. You know, I don't need to flood this thing 2 feet, okay? We're talking 2 inches is all I need. So I basically harvest this water, redirect it, and saturate the fields before it runs into the creeks. And I have a pretty extensive system of culverts and ditches over the years. When you drove here, you notice my road is elevated from the vineyard floor. That's the purpose, keeping the water in the vineyard. Plus, it's slanted toward the vineyard. That's to prevent runoff from cars to go into the creek. So the runoff goes into a biostrip in the vineyard. So I basically engineered this to capture as much of the water as I can.
So if you didn't do any of this stuff, you didn't the trellising, the dry farming, using the valley itself to mm-hmm. run water over this, and you just did drip irrigation from the well, how much water would you be using?
Well,
as compared to how much you use by doing all these techniques.
Well, I'll give you a very simple number. Under normal years, I don't use any water.
But during the deep drought, he's had to use some water from his wells. He views the aquifer below the vineyard as a bank, and Jean-Pierre says he's loath to make withdrawals. But if he did none of these water-saving techniques and just drilled for it, how much water would he need? That answer is a little complex, but in a normal year it comes to about 8 gallons of water per vine about every 10 days during the growing season. And in a densely planted vineyard, That's a lot of water.
The vine density can range from 300 vines per acre to, in the extreme high-density planting, you're looking at 900 plus, you know, 4x4. That's, you've seen vineyards like that, 4x4. I mean, you need these tiny little Italian tractors to go in between. You know, 16 years ago, people would say, "Why the heck is he doing this?" And I was, to be candid with you, looked a little bit as a lunatic.
It's that guy from Europe.
Yeah, he's got a weird accent, and, you know, he's not even second-generation farmer. What the heck does he know? So I kind of, a little bit like the steelhead, you know, I went against the flow. And now people ask me to give presentation on dry farming.
I'm involved with Cal Poly and one of the big grape growers and wineries in California makes a wine that is sold at Trader Joe. You may have heard the name, $2, Chuck, right? And so, you know, one of the two brothers is sitting next to me, and we had this presentation on bioengineering and, you know, this concept of using cacti genes, etc. And at my table, I said, "Gee, Jean-Pierre," I said, "you know, we could save thousands and thousands of dollars in water. This is absolutely fantastic." The fellow next to me said, "Yeah, because now you could make $1, Chuck." So. Thank you.